It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, lies that last. Why we believe things that aren't true, like urban legends, political lies, and the Oklahoma basement myth. Oklahoma is famous for tornadoes, and the safest place to be in a tornado is a basement, right? But in Oklahoma, they don't have many basements. In fact, only 3% of homes have them. Why? Well, because for a long time, the people in Oklahoma have believed that you can't build basements in their soil. That's not actually true, but try convincing anyone in Oklahoma of that. Producer Charles Monroe Kane called Mike Hancock, a guy with a tough job. He's a basement contractor in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Mike, why do you think people have this mindset? Why aren't people building basements? I mean, they would be safer if they did.
People would be safer if they could build, if they would build basements. Absolutely, 100%.
And they can, because you've built 800 of them.
And they can, and we have built a lot of them. Yes, that's true.
Not to get too dark, but about a year ago, we're coming up on the anniversary here in Moore, Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
The city was devastated. Everyone had to rebuild.
Yes.
I mean, I'm afraid I know the answer to this question, but did they rebuild with basements?
Of the 8,000 plus houses and structures that were actually taken out down there, I received basically two calls for, let's look at the option of doing a basement. We're literally going to be putting a small basement, if you want to call it. That's really not a true basement like you would think of in Wisconsin or in Kansas City or Chicago. It is literally a storm shelter type of basement that's a 20 by 20 so they can go down during the storm. Out of all of that, I'm only going to do one.
You're only going to do one?
I'm going to do one.
Now, there's a government subsidy from the state of Oklahoma that pays for basements, right?
There is a government subsidy, and there has been in the past also in 2006, I believe, we had another tornado through the Moore area, and there was a government subsidy that actually did contribute to paying for storm shelters and basements.
Mike, I got to admit, it kind of blows my mind. Doesn't it blow your mind?
It does. It really is frustrating. It's a very, very frustrating to go talk to people every day. I mean, a good example is we'll be at the Chesapeake Arena where the Oklahoma City Thunder play basketball, and they're playing basketball in the basement of the arena, and the guy next to me will say, you can't put basements in Oklahoma.
Jeez.
And I can ask him, where'd you park? I parked next door at the Cox Convention Center. Well, that's in the basement of the Cox Convention Center. It's just like, and they'll still say, you can't do that.
Now, that is a hell of a myth, isn't it? A hell of a myth that turns down free money and could save your family. That is a myth. You're not from Oklahoma, are you?
No, I am not from Oklahoma originally. Right. I am from Kansas originally. And we all have basements in every house. 150 miles north of here, every house has a basement in it. In Oklahoma, you just cross this magic border, and it says, oh, we got to change our whole mindset and do something completely different here. And I don't know where it truly comes from, but it is truly a mindset that is really hard to break. You know, if everybody says no, then that must be the way it is, because that has to be real and that has to be the facts. Instead of doing your research and checking into it, a lot of people just go with, oh, it's easier for me and it's real simple for me to just go with the crowd versus going against the crowd and saying, oh, I want to do a basement.
Mike Hancock builds basements in Edmond, Oklahoma. He talked with Charles Monroe Kane. So we're talking about lies that last in this hour. Myths that hang around for years, decades, even after they've been proved false. So how do these things get started in the first place? Well, let's take the case of the crack babies.
In the United States this year, at least 100,000 crack babies will be born. Today, the government said it will cost $5 billion a year to care for such babies. And money doesn't begin to tell the whole story.
Drugs take away the dream from every child's heart and replace it with a nightmare.
Within days, we were getting calls from media all over the country.
They tend to be what we call jittery.
They're very, very high risk for cerebral palsy, mental retardation.
They are prone to hypertension, strokes, and sudden infant death syndrome.
These children, who are the most expensive babies ever born in America, are going to overwhelm every social service delivery system that they come in contact with throughout the rest of their lives.
That was 60 Minutes, Dan Rather and Peter Jennings, reporting in 1985. Well, the first long-term study of the effect of crack cocaine on babies in the womb has just come out, And it says that those crack babies were a myth. Steve Paulson kind of found that hard to believe, so he tracked down Dr. Ira Chasnoff. He's a professor of pediatric medicine at the University of Illinois. Dr. Chasnoff was one of the go-to medical experts on crack babies back in the 1980s. When the story exploded in the national media, he was part of it.
Well, we started seeing this in the media, and it was an interesting experience with interviews. People would ask questions, and we would answer them, and this happened not just to me, but to many other researchers, that we would answer questions, and then we would see the answers, just little snippets of it, and began to realize that this was getting out of control. And then it was quite disappointing when we published our data at 2 and 3 years and showed that, you know, IQ, global developmental scores were normal. We saw a swing in the media the other way that was declaring there's nothing wrong with using cocaine during pregnancy. And that absolutely was not a message that we wanted going out to the public. And so we kept seeing these fluctuations from one extreme to the other, when what we were trying to do through research is bring it to the middle and bring some common sense to understanding what the real issues were.
Well, let's bring the story closer to the present then. Dr. Hallam Hurt, who back all those decades ago was chair of neonatology at Philadelphia's Albert Einstein Medical Center, she launched a study into the long-term effects crack had on children exposed to the drug in the womb. And almost a quarter of a century after beginning her research, Dr. Hurt now says America's rampant fears about crack babies were, in her words, unwarranted. Crack babies are now considered a myth. Do you agree?
Well, sure. The whole idea that was painted in the media certainly did not have any truth to it then, and it doesn't have any truth to it now. So, you know, was it a myth? Is it a myth that cocaine has effects on pregnancy and newborn outcome? No, it is not a myth. Is it a myth that crack babies were doomed to lives of these terrible lives? No, that's not, that part of the myth is not true at all. On the other hand, alcohol certainly has been shown to cause significant risk for intellectual disabilities.
So you're saying actually alcohol taken when a mother is pregnant has far bigger risks than cocaine?
You can look at it from multiple directions, just from the perspective of how many infants are exposed to alcohol versus how many are exposed to cocaine. Alcohol overwhelmingly is used much more frequently. Does alcohol affect IQ? Yes, there are many studies that show that alcohol does affect, again, overall cognitive functioning. It affects IQ, whereas cocaine does not.
Yeah. And yet my sense is that in the popular media, I mean, in what most of us believe to this day, there still is the sense that there are such things as crack babies, and that's a real problem. And there are all kinds of medical and even cognitive problems associated with babies born this way. I mean, that's out there in the air still, isn't it?
I think it is. I think that we have a very short attention span in this country, and we tend to go from one drug to the next as far as where our concern is focused. The reality is it's a polydrug environment. If a pregnant woman is using any of the drugs that you want to mention, she's most likely also using alcohol and or tobacco. And the question is, how do you pull all of that apart? And that's where it comes down to a lot of the politics and the perceptions of society of what we want to believe and what we don't want to believe.
So I guess the question is, if we would just want to focus on the so-called crack babies for a moment, and I mean, you've basically said there really is no such thing as a crack baby. I mean, that term was invented by the media. It does not come from the medical literature. But a lot of people still believe that. And I guess the question is, why? If this has been shown more or less to be a false belief.
I think the reason people still try to use terms like crack baby is it's a very pejorative term. You know, we're a very verbal society. So if you say circus, people have an image of three rings, lots of action, animals, clowns. If you say crack baby, the image invariably is one of black inner city populations. Now, the reality is we know that's not true, but that's the image that's out there. And that's why you continue to see people using that term. And unfortunately, what happens is what should be a public health issue evolves into a public law issue. It becomes a legal issue. And that's when legislatures try to start passing laws about putting pregnant women in jail, taking babies away. It's a very reflexive kind of action based on perceptions of who these people are that use crack. And the reality is the use of drugs and alcohol and tobacco goes across all social classes, all economic classes. We published an article in 1990 in the New England Journal of Medicine that addressed this issue, because as we saw this so-called crack baby frenzy going on, we asked the question, okay, who really is using drugs during pregnancy? And what is the perception of physicians as to who's using drugs in pregnancy? And so we did a study, and what we showed is that even though the use of drugs and alcohol were the same when we did blinded urine toxicologies in black and white women, physicians were 10 times more likely to do a urine toxicology and report a woman to child welfare to have her baby taken away if she was black.
In retrospect, as you look back on your own role in the way the story about crack babies developed, would you have done anything differently?
You know, at the time, I felt some responsibility for making sure that people understood that cocaine was not safe to use during pregnancy. It was a public health issue. We approached it as a public health perspective. I think I would have been more aggressive in trying to set aside or correct some of the erroneous information that was getting out there. I think, you know, I could have been more aggressive in trying to correct some of the misinformation that was getting out there.
Ira Chasnoff. He's a professor of pediatric medicine at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. Steve Paulson talked with him. It's kind of fascinating to see some of the old media coverage of crack babies. You can take a look at some of it on our website at ttbook.org. The question of how and why we come to believe lies fascinates filmmaker Errol Morris. It's a theme that runs through all of his films, The Thin Blue Line, the Oscar-winning Fog of War, and his brand new documentary about former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. It's called The Unknown Known.
I'm really fascinated about how we propagate error, how we come to believe false things, and how we stick with those false beliefs, no matter what. Once convinced that we know the truth, even if it isn't the truth, even smacking us upside the head with a 2x4 isn't going to change much of anything.
You wrote this series of pieces recently in The New Yorker about a neurological problem. I don't know how to say it.
Anosognosia?
There you go.
The anosognosiac's dilemma?
It's like, yes. But so
it's a neurological problem that prevents you from knowing that you have that neurological problem. I was writing about something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where these two scientists had done an elaborate series of social science experiments about if you're incompetent, you're usually too incompetent to know how incompetent you really are. That incompetence prevents you from an awareness of
your
incompetence.
Incompetence.
The Dunning-Kruger effect. What a wonderful effect. And they called it a kind of social anosognosia. It's interesting, in these two movies that I've made, really they are movies about war, The Fog of War and now The Unknown Known. Again, about war and how we stumble into it for reasons often that can't be reconstructed, that aren't rational. There was a screening of The Fog of War here at the University of Wisconsin campus last night. And one of the most striking things about that story is that McNamara saw himself as a supremely rational man, that the problems of the world could be solved with rationality. And at the very end of the movie, he tells us, and it's one of the really sad lines that I've ever put on film, he says, rationality will not save us. It's this idea that somehow there are forces beyond our ken, forces beyond our control, that somehow drag us into conflict.
There's that moment in the film. Actually, you know what? I think we've got it queued up. This is when he's talking about the decision to bomb after the Gulf of Tonkin torpedo attack.
Now, where are these torpedoes coming from? Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft.
There were sonar soundings. Torpedoes had been detected. Other indications of attack from patrol boats. We spent about 10 hours that day trying to find out what in the hell had happened. At one point, the commander of the ship said, we're not certain of the attack. Another point, they said, yes, we're absolutely positive. And then finally, late in the day, Admiral Sharp said, yes, we're certain it happened. So I reported this to Johnson, and as a result, there were bombing attacks on targets in North Vietnam.
What's so interesting about this is that I'm struck just listening to it here in the studio. We went to war on the basis of something that never happened. We later learned that that second attack in the Gulf of Tonkin did not occur. If you like, it's the WMDs of 40 years before Iraq.
But I think, I'm thinking of Hannah Arendt and the her concept of the banality of evil, and in a way what you're interested in or what we're talking about is sort of the banality of the accidental reasons we go to war. You know, it's not as though people all planned or knew even that this was going to be the pivotal moment. They got some information, they made a few mistakes. It was probably accidents and errors that kind of compounded from one person to another as they passed bits of information down a chain. But the result was a war that killed hundreds of thousands of people.
In the case of Vietnam, 58,000 American servicemen and literally millions of Vietnamese.
So I think that what it seems to me that one of the things that you should tell me that fascinates you is that chain of deception, those lies.
I'm not sure that I would even call them lies. It's all unanswerable. There's this idea, everyone's familiar with it, the marketplace of ideas. Somehow, if everybody is allowed to chatter away unendingly, that the truth will will out.
Right, this idea that we live in an increasingly transparent society. And
this is something I don't agree with. The truth doesn't magically appear for any of us. The marketplace of ideas, thank you, Adam Smith, doesn't produce truth. But it's the job of all of us, journalists, historians, investigators, you name it, is to pursue the truth. The truth is outside of us and beyond us. We may never be able to grab a hold of it, but we search for it. We try to find out what is true and what is false to the best of our abilities.
Well, thank you. It's a great place to leave it. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Errol Morris is an Oscar-winning director. His films include The Thin Blue Line, The Fog of War, and his latest, The Unknown Known. And this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about lies that last in this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio, and if there's one thing we know here in America's Dairyland, it's cows. So as long as we're talking about lies that last, have you ever tried to tip a cow?
So the idea, the popular conception of cow tipping is that on a semi-regular basis, young men, usually drunk, go out into the countryside, find a dairy cow, and sneak up on it. The cow is sleeping while it's standing on its feet. And the young men, sometimes just one, sometimes it's a couple, run up and just give it a good old shove, and down the cow goes. And it's a great laugh for everybody. And I think if you quiz a room of people who maybe grew up in more suburban or urban areas and said, is cow tipping real? Most people would say, yeah, oh yeah.
That's Jake Swearingen of Modern Farmer magazine. And he says the truth is, no one can tip a cow. He told Charles Monroe Kane he has physics and even YouTube to back him up.
In 2005, there was a student at the University of British Columbia named Tracy Beauchler who did basically the rough equation of what it would take to tip a cow. That equation was later refined by Dr. Marco Lilly, and they published a small paper on it, and that paper sort of blew up. It was published in numerous newspapers. I think maybe much to Dr. Margot Lilly's regret. Talking to her, you get the sense that, you know, she's a very serious doctor of zoology, and somehow cow tipping has become what she's most known for. But they basically run through what the physics would require to tip a cow, and they're daunting, to say the least.
You know, there's this joke I always remember, you know, a guy walks into a bar, tries to pick up a woman, and she says, you know, get away from me. You have a 1 in a million chance for me to ever go out with you. And he's like, yeah, I got a chance.
So you're saying there's a chance.
But I look at it, I think to myself, well, in certain, you know, conditions, if you got your physics right. But you're saying not in real-world conditions.
So let's say that you wanted to tip a cow. And let's also sort of posit that you exist in a universe where there's the platonic ideal of the typical cow. The creator of this universe has decided, you know what, cows actually should go over on their side as much as possible. Okay. So to do that, you would create a cow that's basically a rigid rectangular body. Think of basically like a refrigerator that stands at about 4.5 feet tall or 1.5 meters, weighs about 682 kilograms, and that's about 1,500 pounds, and is completely unreactive. As you start pushing against it, it will not do anything. Even if you take all that into account, you're going to need 1,360 newtons of force. So once Dr. Margot Lilly really started to take all that into account, her equation showed that 5 very strong people could possibly do it. And really, it's more like 6 people of average strength could tip a cow. But here's the real problem is that you need to generate all of this force. And you generate force, you know, the equation for force is force equals mass times acceleration. And so you, even if you have these 6 people, you can't, ideally, you're not going to all be able to increase your own mass, you know, at will. I can't increase my own body weight at will without a lot of time in the gym or, you know, various other methods.
Yes.
The only thing that you can change is your acceleration. So you not only have to get 5 or 6 people to come up on a cow that's awake, that's going to be reactive, that's going to be bracing itself, that's going to be trying to moving away from you, but you have to come at it very, very quickly. So you need to increase that amount of acceleration, which again just adds a whole nother layer of complexity. And the final part that she points out is that, so imagine, again, that a cow is sort of this refrigerator that you're trying to push over. and you have a refrigerator and you want to tip it over on its side, you don't push straight across. You don't push at 180 degrees relative to the, you know, plane of the earth. You actually have to push upward a little bit. So you need to get six people that also probably like go to the gym and do a lot of squats that have a lot of the ability to sort of generate upward thrust as well. And so all of that put together just creates this sort of situation where it's really, 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 really difficult, even with six people all moving in concert, to get a cow over into its side.
Well, there you go. The physics has spoken. Now, did you think this was real before you started this? To be honest.
I really highly doubted it was real. I grew up in Oklahoma. You know, I had been around cows. I understood how large they were, but I still, you never know. You know,
human
beings are, we're really ingenious creatures, you know. We went to the moon, you know.
Yeah, we're stupid and smart. It's a great mix.
Exactly. I didn't want to discount the idea that maybe somewhere out there, like, it had happened, even if on the face of it, it seemed highly unlikely.
Now, your strongest argument, in my opinion, is the YouTube phenomena argument. Can you tell us that?
Sure. You know, when I first started writing this article, you know, one of the things, the first things that I did, honestly, was just go onto YouTube and start looking around to see if there was any sort of example of cow tipping. YouTube, to my mind, is sort of, it is the clearinghouse of human stupidity. You can go and find literally thousands of videos of kids taking the cinnamon challenge, where they put a teaspoon of cinnamon in their mouth and they end up gagging and nearly throwing up. Kids jumping off roofs onto trampolines, you know, so many examples of people lighting fireworks indoors. It's just sort of nonstop stupidity because that gets attention on the internet. And I think cow tipping is a really stupid thing. And yet there's not a single example of it. And so to my mind, that's sort of the final nail in the coffin of the idea of cow tipping being an actual thing beyond a rural legend.
Well, thank you very, very much. And hopefully this will stop people from trying to go tip cows all across the country.
Yeah, I cannot emphasize enough. It is a really dumb and dangerous thing to even attempt to do. And even if you go attempt it, the cow's going to stay upright and you're going to end up in the mud.
I am cow, hear me moo. I weigh twice as much as you, and I look good on the barbecue. Yogurt, curd, cream, cheese, and butter's made from liquid from my udders. I am cow, hear me moo.
Charles Monroe Kane talked with Jake Swearingen of Modern Farmer magazine. Now, hey, if you want to check the math on that cow tipping equation, it's on our website at ttbook.org. Do I look okay in this? We all know the answer, right? You look great in it, even if that's not quite true. Most of us tell little white lies from time to time. Your new outfit looks good. The chicken liver was delicious. Is there anything wrong with telling the occasional white lie? Steve Paulson asked Sam Harris. He's a philosopher and neuroscientist and the author of a new book called Lying.
Well, I have to ask you about white lies, the little fibs that lubricate social relationships, you know, saying nice things about the coworker's new hairstyle or dress, which you actually think is hideous. Is there anything wrong with that?
Yeah, certainly. Just imagine how the rest of the day plays out. So you actually think it's hideous. You lie to this person's face, telling them how beautiful the dress is, and then you might very well divulge to another person when that first person leaves that what an awful dress that is, and you've just established that you're this kind of person who really can't be trusted to give his actual opinion when it's awkward to do so. Do you want to be that kind of person? I don't want to be that kind of person. And I don't want, if I ask someone whose opinion I value what they think of something, I actually want to know what they think. Part of this is this problem is held in place by people who ask for opinions when they really just want praise. They don't actually want to know the truth. They don't want to know how they're perceived. And so there are people who will be offended when you are actually straight with them. But you can begin to train the people in your life to realize that you're the kind of person who well, tell them what you think. And it's not that you're deliberately trying to hurt people's feelings. You're trying to give people the information that you would want to have if you were in their position.
You might not want that information. I mean, there's another way to look at this. I mean, you are basically taking a very literal approach to human relationships. I mean, the question is whether honesty is always the best way to connect with other people, because the other way to look at this is you could say they're not really asking for your opinion. It's all about social bonding, you know, that little chit-chat to establish more intimacy.
I'm not advocating a kind of Tourette-ic inability to censor yourself or to be civil or to be tactful. So it's not that. But there are occasions where someone, where the subtext really carries the meaning. So someone is asking, they seem to be asking for your literal opinion, but what you know or believe you know is that they're asking just to be reassured, or they just want a hug. They just want to know that you love them, or whatever it is. And if you think that the subtext really is the message and that the text is just distraction, well, then fine. But then you can honestly address the subtext. But it's greatly clarifying for everyone to just be the kind of person who will say what you think. And because you're actually on the moment you realize that you're on the same team with the people you care about, and you can care about a lot. These just don't have to be your best friends. You can care about the well-being of virtually everyone you meet. Then you just have to ask yourself, what information would I want in there? What is true and useful? And when you find yourself tempted to just lie outright, I think you've failed to collaborate with this person. You don't feel like you're on their team anymore. You're protecting your team. You're just avoiding the awkwardness of saying something that might not be comfortable to hear. But we really do our friends no favors when we fail to give them information that we believe we have about how they're appearing in the world, how they're performing. When someone asks you to criticize their book or their artwork, when someone's asking your opinion, to fail to give it is not actually a sign of friendship. It's just emotionally easier when your opinion is that you don't like it.
But it seems to me that if you're going to make this kind of commitment to total honesty, you need a lot of emotional intelligence to be able to do that, so that you don't alienate that person. I mean, you know, it's how you phrase something. It's the tone that you have. I mean, it sort of has to be just right. Otherwise, it's so easy to come off as sounding self-righteous and alienating.
Well, but also it's just you need a nuanced view of what the truth actually is. So, for instance, there are many situations where you're asked to give your opinion, but your opinion isn't some unbiased window onto the nature of reality. Your opinion is just your opinion. So if you don't happen to like a dress, that doesn't mean the dress is objectively ugly. And so you can discount the value of your opinion in real time. And the moment you're telling the truth, you can always refine what you say. If the first thing that comes out of your mouth doesn't sound exactly right, you can say, well, actually, that's not what I mean. I mean to say X. And you can keep just shaping it in conversation. Now, a lie doesn't perform that way. A lie is just this brittle thing that you have to keep track of to make sure that you're not misrepresenting it later on, so that you know, people don't notice that you're lying. The truth can always just be found in conversation, and it's immensely relieving of a kind of anxiety that I didn't even know I had, to know that when I go into situations, I'm just going to tell the truth. You know, there's nothing to calculate for. There's nothing, and this especially goes to misrepresenting yourself. I mean, it's one thing to talk about other people's clothes and haircuts and to give them advice, but the people who misrepresent themselves are carrying this burden of having to pretend to be someone they're not, in often in very subtle but still insidious ways. And I mean, there's a whole facade of deception that you can just cut right through as long as you're willing to be yourself in a conversation.
Is this something that you've had to work out yourself? I mean, the fact that you are so interested in this whole question of lying and honesty, I mean, have you sort of changed your thinking about this or taken this to a deeper, more personal level in your own life?
Well, it was something that it actually came very early for me, or earlier than any of my other published interests. I as a freshman at Stanford, I took a course with this professor who actually still teaches the same course, Ron Howard, who's in the Engineering Economic Systems Department. But he taught this course on several courses on ethics, and one was just on whether it's ever ethical to lie. And it was just a single question that organized the course. I don't frankly remember what I thought about Lyon before I took this course, but I came out the other side of this thing. It was like a machine for producing people who then felt very uncomfortable lying. And I came out just amazed at what the analogy I give somewhere in the book is that I felt like I had discovered a bomb at the center of my life and had been given the tools to defuse it before it went off. And then I saw this bomb going off in everyone else's life, in you know, both real and fictional, in literature and in the news and in the people around me. I saw the way people were damaging their reputations, damaging public conversation, damaging their relationships by lying. And so once I got my head straight about this around when I was 18, 19, it was a huge relief. And so I'm just writing about it now, but it's been something that has been true for me for a couple of decades now.
Steve Paulson talking with Sam Harris, the author of Lying. And we're pausing here for a spoiler alert. Parents, if you celebrate Christmas and you have young children, you might want to make sure there aren't any kids around because Steve's about to mention...
Santa Claus. What do you say when your five-year-old daughter asks you if Santa's real?
Yeah, well, this was the most common question I got from initial readers of my book. I heard from many people who seemed to anticipate this, who remembered what it was like to find out that their parents had been lying to them for years every Christmas, and how destabilizing they found that to be. They felt emotionally wounded by the fact that these people who were ostensibly the closest people to them and the most trustworthy people in the universe had been lying over and over again in ways that they could not detect. But as a parent, I have absolutely no temptation to lie to my daughter about Santa Claus. First of all, she loves Christmas. She loves the fiction of Christmas. And we know, everyone knows, 364 days a year that fiction is rewarding and immensely satisfying for kids. So we don't lie about Harry Potter and Tolkien, and we don't lie about Halloween and Superman and Batman. All of these things can be totally captivating for kids, and arguably many of them would be more captivating if we lied about them. If you said that, yes, the dragons in Middle Earth are real and you might see them any day now, okay, well, you could get a 4, 5, 6-year-old to be perpetually on his or her guard for dragons. Now, that would be captivating. But I see absolutely no evidence in my daughter's life that she would be better off believing that Santa is real.
Sam Harris is a philosopher and neuroscientist. He and Steve were talking about Sam's new book, which is called Lying.
So you better watch out. You better not cry. Better not call. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list.
I'm checking it twice.
Sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake.
Oh, you better watch out, watch out, not cry, I'm telling you why, Santa Claus is coming to town.
We've been talking about lies that last, popular myths and urban legends. Maybe you got one to share. If you do, you can post it on our Facebook page. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Eric Liu. I'm the author of A Chinaman's Chance and founder of Citizen University. The book I want to talk about is called Inventing America by Gary Wills. Inventing America is a book of his that is less known and yet I think is really one of the great classics, not only in his canon, but in the American canon. It was first published in 1978, and what it does is it is a philosophical excavation of what went into Jefferson's writing of the Declaration of Independence. Unlike other books of Wills's where he actually breaks down the text word by word, he's not really doing that in this book. In Inventing America, what he's doing is he's tracing all of the philosophical and moral and ethical antecedents of norms and belief and values that shaped Jefferson and his cohort and that find their way into the language and the vibe, the spirit of the Declaration. And the reason why I'm so fascinated with this book actually connects with my interest in writing about Chinese-American identity, because part of what Gary Wills is arguing ultimately is that Jefferson was shaped by thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, whose views were fundamentally that life is not about individuals bouncing off each other atomistically or mechanistically, but it is about this weave of a relationship and obligation. There is no such thing as a right untethered from a responsibility. And today, Americans look back the founding generation and think of all of them as kind of hyper-proto-libertarians, all of them screaming, "Don't tread on me, I'm my own man and I made myself." And what Gary Wills reminds us is that entire founding generation was shaped by a much deeper communitarian ethic, a much deeper belief in context and social norms and the requirements that society becomes how you behave. And that's a reminder, kind of a subdominant theme in the American song that I want to turn up the volume on and why I find this book so powerful. I discovered this book when I was working on my just prior book called The Gardens of Democracy. Well, the title of it actually suggests part of the argument that says that so much of the way we think about American life is in terms of machines. We think about the economy as a big cogs and gears machine. We think about politics as checks and balances and regulation. But the machine metaphor blinds us in many ways to the reality, which is that our society, our economy, our neighborhoods, our communities, our families are not machines. They are gardens. They're complex, adaptive ecosystems, and gardens require gardeners. They require tending and weeding and seeding as citizens, as participants. And as I was researching for that book, I came upon this book of Gary Wills's, Inventing America, and it just lit me up, this realization that this wasn't just me here in this day and age wishing that this was part of the American inheritance. Here was Gary Wills telling us that it was part of the American inheritance.
Eric Liu recommends Inventing America by Gary Wills. For more bookmarks, check our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. With the second beheading of an American journalist by the Islamic militant group ISIL, the perils of being a foreign war correspondent have never been so clear. It takes a special kind of courage and dedication to risk your life covering war and conflict. In the past 20 years, more than 60 journalists have died covering conflicts in Syria alone. Many more have been captured and tortured. Among them, the celebrated war correspondent Anthony Lloyd. Earlier this year, he and photographer Jack Hill, both working for the Times of London, were kidnapped by Syrian rebels. Lloyd was severely beaten and shot twice before he managed to escape to Turkey. Now, why do journalists like Lloyd do this? Risk their lives over and over again? Today, we're revisiting Steve Paulson's interview with Lloyd from a decade ago, back when he just published his memoir, My War Gone By, I Miss It So. They started by talking about his first assignment as a photojournalist during the Balkan War.
You didn't have to look very far in Sarajevo to see, the war up pretty close. And the house I was living in was actually pretty well slap bang on the front line, so close to the front line that we could only live in about four of the seven rooms in the house because bullets would come through the windows of the other rooms because they were overlooking the Serb positions directly. And you had to run to get out the front door. You had to run. And the house was hit by fire on a very frequent basis.
And I got the impression that once you went outside, it was kind of like running a gauntlet, especially if you crossed certain streets.
Yeah, there was this fairly notorious street known as Sniper's Alley outside, which was a wide kind of thoroughfare overlooked by high ground to the south, upon which there were, Serb positions, snipers, and machine guns, etc. So Yeah, you had to run pretty fast across that street.
Early on in the book, you write that you wanted to know what it was like to shoot people. And you were actually given the chance by a Bosnian sniper you had gotten to know. Can you tell me about what happened?
Sure. Just to clarify that a bit, I wanted to know what it was to have the psychology of the snipers, because it was so much a sniper's war in Sarajevo. The majority of the people killed in those early days were killed by snipers. So I wanted to know how they thought of their life and their job. And I went off into the hills just at the north side of Sarajevo with a sniper to see him at work. He had a, this was at night. He had a starlight scope. There was some fighting going on at the front. Lots of sound and light from various weapons on the front. And after a bit, he got bored because of the fighting. Everyone was quite low in their trenches, and he handed me the weapon. And surprise, surprise, after a while, a Serb soldier jumped up out of his trench, I think to take a leak, actually. I could see him very clearly in the starlight scope. And I realized how very easy it must be, particularly as a sniper, when you're at a distance, you know, you've got this guy in the scope, it'd be very easy just to squeeze that trigger, and you'd be totally removed from the fact that you're actually taking life. It would just be a hit. That form of killing was very different to some of the other forms of killings that done in the war, which were up close and personal and done with a knife or through execution or shooting at very close range. But sniping was the kind of weapon form which caused the most fear, I'd say, in Sarajevo.
Well, you write that a lot of the people who ended up in Bosnia, from the UN general down to the BBC correspondent, the aid worker, the mercenary, and you as well, you all wanted the same thing, as you put it, a hit off the action, a walk on the dark side.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. I think that what everyone's job in war, altruism is possible, but it always comes second to one's primary motivation for going, which, if one has a choice, is a personal motivation. I mean, why go to someone's war voluntarily, except certainly in the initial cases, out of curiosity? And, you know, I've met all these people. I've known, you know, senior UN officers very well, well-established TV personalities and war correspondents, etc., etc. And in my mind, at least, they're all linked by the same thing, in that, first of all, they go to war out of a sense of challenge and curiosity. And let's not forget as well, war is pretty damn exciting.
How far did you walk on the dark side?
Well, it took me a long time to come back from however far it was once I returned to peacetime London at the end of it all. But I don't know. I mean, I think that's... Sorry, Steve, that's quite a relative question. I don't know how to answer it, you know?
Well, I guess, I mean, early on, you write about how you still had a sense of ethics, and there was still something kind of shocking about seeing people get whacked.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to disappear after a while.
Yeah, I think one's threshold is never raised, or is it lowered, so far that one becomes inured to scenes of really shocking mutilation, but certainly the kind of mild horror and surprise that one expresses at the first casualties one sees in a war does fade out pretty quickly, really perhaps for no more complex reason than you see a lot of people getting killed in war, or certainly a lot of dead people. And if one's perpetually shocked and horrified, one's own resilience is going to be eroded pretty quickly.
There's another thing that comes out in your account of all of this, the macabre kind of sensibility that would sometimes come out of a few episodes. For instance, the time when, I guess it was a Jordanian truck driver, had accidentally driven into a Croat zone and when it was gunned down. And you write about how someone reached into the truck and straightened him up and his brain rolled out.
Yeah, Steve, no, he was a bit more than a truck driver. He was a Mujahideen fundamentalist fighter who had gone in with a fire team of four other guys, got lost and driven into the Croat zone, guys he'd been fighting with only a couple of days earlier, and did a frantic U-turn when he realized his mistake to try and get out of it. Died in a hail of gunfire. And yes, exactly that. It's the kind of Croats started prodding at the bodies with, you know, sticks and metal rods, almost like a kind of foreplay to mutilation. One of them hauled him up, and the guy's brain popped out in the road, and then a cat ran out and grabbed the brain. That was pretty macabre.
Did you satisfy your war lust after you'd seen a lot of it?
No. in some ways, the more you saw, the more gripping it became. And since those years, I've been working as a foreign reporter for the Times of London, going to other wars. So I guess the answer is no, my curiosity for war wasn't satisfied.
Now, there's another piece to this story. You became addicted to heroin. How did this fit into what you were doing during this war?
Well, Steve, how it worked is, having gone out to Bosnia at the beginning of 1993 and spent till mid-1996 there, really, each year I was out there, I would come back for perhaps a couple of months each year to the UK. And I found, partly to do with who I was, partly to do with who I was hanging out with in London, and partly a lot, in fact, to do with the difficulties of splicing up, you know, suddenly appearing in peacetime London, that by taking heroin, you could just transcend the whole contradiction and just, you know, not have to face it or deal with it, which sort of worked. War for work and heroin for holidays until the war finished, and I just got left with a habit.
Well, the title of your book is My War Gone By, I Miss It So. You really meant that, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, Steve, my experience of war was a very paradoxical one, because I think that is the nature of war. I certainly can't sit here and go, yeah, war, it's great. But I can't sit here either and be, you know, going through all the usual dull platitudes and cliches about, oh, yeah, it's horrible and revolting. You know, it's both. There are elements there that are really repulsive, and one sees, you know, man at his worst, and often oneself at one's worst too. And there are also elements which are extremely exciting, extremely fulfilling, extremely interesting, and really gripping. And when the Bosnian War finished, God knows, I wouldn't wish it to start again for those poor people. But on another level, yeah, I miss it. It's the most definitive period of my life. It was the best time of my life.
Just because it was so exciting?
It was very exciting, and everything is raised to a new intensity. The friendships one has, the relationships one has, the day-by-day, you know, feeling of feeling alive, and you're somewhere where you feel all your senses are elevated, and it matters. And also, from my mind, that was the most important event in Europe since 1945. We had the same terms coming up again as issues which we hadn't had since the Second World War: fascism, nationalism, multi-ethnicity, tolerance, ethnic tolerance, you know, mass killing and atrocity. It was a big deal. It was a big deal. So to have had all of the former in the environment of the latter was the e-ticket ride.
Anthony Lloyd, talking with Steve Paulson about a decade ago. In May of this year, Lloyd was kidnapped by Syrian rebels, severely beaten and shot twice before he escaped to Turkey. This year, he won the Foreign Reporter of the Year award. More than 60 journalists have died in Syria alone since 1992. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.